you will increase your efficiency 20% if you learn to do the tough things first, the ones you don't want to do.
Ray Zinn now imparts his management philosophy in Tough Things First. In this series, Zinn covers it all, from the essence of human happiness,
adding value, showing that you have value,
to the downside of venture capital.
You will not own the company.
And the essence of entrepreneurial discipline.
If you're going to make it a consistent practice of working Saturdays just because you think you've got to work 80 hours a week to be successful, you're just flat out wrong.
Now here's Ray Zinn, Silicon Valley's longest serving CEO and today's guest host.
Well, welcome back to another edition of the Tough Things First podcast. And I've got to tell you, this is going to be one of the most special editions that we've created today. We have with us different guests, students from different Zen Starter schools. And these schools were selected by Ray Zinn and given money so that the students there, the student entrepreneurs, could kickstart their ventures, begin to move their products, their business ideas out into the world. And they all have read Ray's book, and they're excited to be with us. We're excited to have them. And of course, first, we're most excited to have Ray Zinn with us as always. How are you doing today, Ray?
Just wonderful. And I am so appreciative of all these wonderful and bright students that are joining us today from all over the United States to be here to kick off this first special podcast of Zinn Starter. So welcome, guys, and thanks again for being a Zinn Starter fellow.
And I'm looking forward to this. The Zinn Starter program has been an astounding success, and it's only in its second year, and we hope to expand it. Per Ray's design, we have been recruiting what they call land-grant colleges, colleges that came to life simply because a hunk of land was donated to the cause. And we're really excited because we're finding entrepreneurs in every corner of the country. So enough of that. Let's actually get these students online because they all have questions for Ray, and I am excited to hear what's on their mind and what kind of advice they're looking for in moving forward with their business projects. And we're going to start with our inaugural school, the first Zinn Starter school, which was Virginia Tech. And with us is Glenn Feit. And Glenn, why don't you tell us just a little bit about your project?
Well, first of all, Ray, thank you so much for having us. I'm really excited to be here on this podcast today. I'm working on to commercialize a medical technology, which will allow patients suspected of having a particular liver disease known as NASH to be tested for it through non-invasive means for the first time.
I find that exciting. There's a lot of things that are going on in med tech right now, which are going to be absolutely revolutionary, and in getting the diagnostics down is the first step. So what question do you have for Ray this morning?
Yeah, I was wondering, Ray, when you started McCrell, you took out bank loans to retain full equity in the company. Would you make that same decision today, given the easier access to capital? And how do you balance giving up equity for raising external funds to fuel faster growth?
Excellent questions. And I read all the ones you guys have asked or wanting to ask. And this is one of the more favorite ones I have. I cover it pretty well in the book. Whether you go bank, angel, venture capital, or family, however you want to fund it, make sure that what the money that you raise will hold you for 2 years at least, or until you get to profitability. Don't just raise enough to get yourself started and then end up having to go back after more and more money. So depending upon the venture that you're going to do and how much capital you're going to need will kind of define where you go to raise the money. It just so happened that because in my case, now this may not be true in your case, I wanted to own the company outright. I did not want to have to share it with a number of other people. So I raised the money through bank financing so I could retain ownership. I had a problem with previous ventures where the other owned it and tried to tell me what to do. And as a consequence of that, I didn't do well. And I have to have at least some control, or more, the majority of the control, so that I could implement the programs that I wanted to do. So it really depends on how much money it's going to take to launch your venture and your time horizon. For example, in the medical field, that's a pretty long horizon to hit the ground, because there may be a lot of testing, a lot of FDA requirements, and so it just depends. It depends upon you. How much ownership do you want to give up? If I had to do it over again, I would do it the same way I'm doing it now. I did, which is to do it with my own money. But don't, I'm not saying any of them are better or worse than others. It just depends upon your project, your vision, mission that you have. And that's what will help determine it. So when you get further into your project and we start looking at what it's going to take to really launch you, then we can better decide how to go and fund your program. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think that makes a lot of sense, Ray. Thank you so much.
Great answer there, Ray. And we're going to move right now to BYU, Ray's alma mater, and talk to Jonathan DePerry. Hello, Jonathan. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Go Cougars.
Well, it's great to have you. Tell us a little bit about your project.
Yeah, so the product I'm working on, I've developed a consumer vibration and heat therapy massage device that's been designed to reduce chronic pain as well as assist in muscular recovery for athletes.
So we actually have two different medical or at least physiological students working with the Zen Starter program and making the world a better place because of that. So go ahead and give us your first question today.
Yeah, perfect. So Ray, until things first, you recommend taking a few years to work in a nonprofit or unprofitable company in order for a CEO to learn better communication and leadership skills before starting their own ventures. But what would you recommend to a young entrepreneur to develop these skills further if they've already started their business and maybe don't have the ability to gain that experience working for another company?
Don't like working for companies that lose money, but getting some experience before you launch your venture, it just means you'll have learned through OJT, on-the-job training, as opposed to having to learn it all yourself. I mean, as a parent, you didn't just become a parent by accident. You were raised by parents, and hopefully they taught you how to be a good parent, and then you could then raise your family properly. So because you're not necessarily going to be able to work for another company before you launch your venture, you're just going to have to apply some good principles. And we cover those in Tough Things First. And it's not magic. It's just a matter of understanding, kind of the parameters, the box that you're in. I mean, it's like when you play a particular sport. If you've never played a sport before, you're going to make mistakes. But if you have a chance to play a sport, then you're going to be more likely to succeed. I don't know of a single university that would bring a player on their team that hadn't played before, either in high school or in some other way, because, otherwise we're kind of starting from scratch. So it's always better to have that upfront training before you launch your company, as opposed to now having to do OJT, where you're going to have to just kind of learn it on the fly. But Tough Things First, the book, which hopefully you're studying, will give you a glimpse into things you need to know and understand. I know because of the fact you're attending BYU that you've got a great university behind you and mentors that can help you, as well as your family and other training that I know you've had to get you to where you are today. So I don't know any other way to explain it than just apply what you know to be good ethical principles that you have learned throughout your life.
I think that was a great question, Jonathan, because one of the things every new entrepreneur faces is how to get along with people in an organization. And occasionally nonprofits are great places to do that because everyone's there because they want to be. So we're going to come to Silicon Valley now, San Jose State University, and Sharik Shah. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am fantastic. Tell us a bit about your project. I understand that you're in music streaming.
Yes, I am. So Ambi is a social music streaming platform. So music streaming platforms already exist in Spotify, Pandora, YouTube Music. But Ambi is made for social listening. So we are trying to address situations where multiple people are listening to everyone's music. We want to be integrated into stores, restaurants, and lounge systems where they would allow their patrons to join the party in that specific establishment and upload, download, and add songs to better contribute to the music experience or the musical ambiance in that area.
Interesting approach to the market. So what is your first question for Ray today?
So you touched on this a little bit, but You launched your career with a very sharp focus. You started in rocket manufacturing, then you transitioned to work as an engineer, and over time you positioned yourself strategically in order to learn everything you could about semiconductor development and management. Then you were able to leverage all of that stuff into developing Micrel as a powerhouse in the industry. What advice would you give to student entrepreneurs without any money, clout, or experience who want to find the same success that you did?
Sharik, those are difficult questions to answer because everybody is unique and the way they want to approach their entrepreneurship. So in my case, my experience was in the manufacturing of semiconductors. Even though I made rocket motors before, I was moving towards semiconductors. I liked that field. I thought that was an exciting field, the one that I thought I could do well in. It's kind of like a person who maybe is in real estate and then decides to become a dentist. They don't connect. You know, they don't come together. So because of the fact that you are a young entrepreneur, meaning you really haven't had a lot of experience, you're going to have to say, where do I want to go? Which way do I want to head in my career? It sounds like music is where you'd like to be. And so if you love something, as they say, you don't work a day in your life. So you have to pick something that you're going to really enjoy. And if music streaming or the music industry is where you'd like to hang your hat, then what you got to do is learn everything you can about that. In my case, I studied diligently while I was working. I mean, I was like a sponge. I was absorbing everything I could about every department, every aspect of the organization, because if you're familiar with semiconductors, they involve a lot. They involve manufacturing and design, of course, marketing, applications, testing, wafer fabrication. There's a whole host of things that you have to learn and manage, a lot of pieces. So, In your particular field, you're going to have to struggle with that and find out what is going to work best for you with your expertise, because don't try something that for which, number one, you're not 100% committed. And second, don't try something that you don't really enjoy or don't think you're going to enjoy long term. Don't make this a hobby. Okay. You know, make this a career.
Excellent answer to that. So let's go back out east to West Virginia University, who has launched into the Zen Starter program with great zeal. And we have from there, Ethan Ball. Hello, Ethan.
Hello, how's it going?
It's going very well. Thank you for being here. And tell us what you're doing with tractor trailers. This one has my particular attention.
All right. Well, my company, GoTel Mobile Accommodations, is a socially driven for-profit company that plans to convert decommissioned tractor trailers into 5 separate amenity-full modular hotel rooms. And we are designing these trailers for clients in the oil, natural gas, and construction industry, sporting events, music festivals, or really any level surface where the trailers can be parked with minimal setup required. These trailers are also designed to cater to natural disaster relief, and our commitment to social values is a fundamental pillar of the organization.
I know some people who went to go work the oil fields up in the Dakotas. I can see where this particular offering would fit in perfectly with the growth explosion happening there right now. So go ahead and ask Ray your first question.
Absolutely. Well, since obviously most entrepreneurs are starting their business by themselves, I know you hit it on it in your book, you know, but what advice can you offer to someone who really struggles with micromanaging, specifically during the very early stages of building a functional support team around you?
Okay. So first let's get your definition of what you call micromanaging. So what is your definition of micromanaging?
Well, for me personally, I just seem to be a little overly involved in some aspects that I really need to pass off, you know, because I'm trying to take on everything from managing the financials to designing the trailers from an engineering perspective. And at the end of the day, I'm just trying to wear too many caps to build this at the scale that I want it to be at.
So do you feel the people that you have involved aren't capable of doing it themselves, and you feel you're the expert, you're the only one that knows how to do it?
Well, I feel personally that I'm the one with the driving vision behind it. So my problem is really finding those people to be on my support system and really finding the people where I'm having the most difficulty.
Finding good people is going to be the challenge for all of you. In fact, anyone who starts a business, finding the right people is key. That's where you differentiate yourself from your competition, because everybody has the same brick and mortar. Everybody has the same type of facilities. The differentiation really is the people. The people are the key to the strength and quality of the company that you have. So, being able to source the right people is going to be the challenge that you're going to face and you will continue to face throughout your business career. You know, what you do is you formulate the questions of listing, like you did the mission for your company. You list down the things you want. Here's what I want for this particular position, the kind of qualities that I am looking for in that person. So the people who are less concerned about themselves and more concerned about the company are the ones you want to hire. The people who are entrepreneurial by nature and just determine from your discussions with them how excited they are. If they're just looking for a job, you probably want to avoid them, unless of course you just have to have their talent. But the people that want to be involved, the people who are excited about what you're doing, those are the ones that are going to put forth the most effort. They're not going to be watching the clock. They're going to be just putting in whatever time and effort it takes to be successful. At Mike Krell, and defined in the book, Tough Things First, we had four cultures. So every employee should have these four cultures. Number one is honesty. Second is integrity. That means doing what's right when no one's watching. The third is to be respectful of everyone, and be kind and understanding as they work with people. And the fourth is doing whatever it takes, no excuses. This is the part that I was talking about finding people who are really interested and enthusiastic about what you're doing. And if they have questions and concerns, you may want to pass on them. So, make sure the people you hire have those four qualities: honesty, integrity, dignity, and respect for other people, and then doing whatever it takes, no excuses.
Well, as long as we're on the topic of values, corporate culture, and whatnot, Glenn at Virginia Tech had another question which centers on work ethics and corporate values. Glenn, why don't you go ahead and ask that other question that you had for Ray?
Yeah, in your book, you talk a lot about the values of having a strong work ethic. And I was wondering, how do you best model and instill plus maintain those values as championed in Tough Things First within an entire organization?
That's a good one, Glenn. So when you set the example, in other words, you as the leader of the band, as they say, set the example. And so working more than 40 or 50 hours a week is really not really very productive. So when we talk about work ethic, it doesn't mean that you're working 24/7 or that you're working, 80 hours a week. The most effective hours that you have are between 4 and 5 hours a day. That's the most productive time. And so if you can focus on what you're doing for at least 4 or 5 hours, you're doing a pretty good job. But if you're trying to stretch that out over 12, 15 hours, you're just trying to fool somebody, and maybe you're fooling yourself. So having a good work ethic means that they're not, off and doing other things, watching a, sports program or involved in some personal financial thing or whatever else, that they're focused on the task at hand. And if you can get 4 to 5 productive hours a day out of your employees, then you're succeeding. And if you just take a look at yourself as a student and look at how productive you are and the work ethic you have as a student, you'll see that, you're not putting in really more than 4 or 5 hours of productive study a day. And so don't expect your employees to put in, 15 to 20 hours a day or 14 hours a day, because they're not going to be productive.
Well, this all touches on the topics of leadership and maintaining, confidence with inside the team. So let's bounce back to BYU and Jonathan. You had a second question that kind of is along these same lines.
Yeah. So my next question was, what tips can you recommend to a young entrepreneur to help them maintain their confidence and their leadership and be able to portray that confidence to their employees while they're still in the process of developing those skills.
That's like looking in the mirror. You know, if you can look in the mirror and feel good about yourself, then that's a start. So having, the willingness and the ability to look at yourself critically and say, you know, what, not so much what can they do more, but what can I do more? If you look at your people, as a like a family or as a treasure, as a valued resource, you're going to treat them better. That's the way you really develop the kind of relationship that'll get your employees to want to be productive. And so in all cases, it's a matter of being respectful and kind and knowing their birthdays, you know, knowing about their desires or their issues. I'd frequently ask my employees about their family. You know, how's Joey doing or how's Susie doing? I would show interest in them as a person, as opposed to, now, what are you doing about this particular part of the project? I very seldom talk to them like that. I mainly talk to them as a person, just like if they were my next door neighbor.
I think this is interesting because it kind of touches on one of your recurring themes in Tough Things First, which is, you know, the center of human happiness and what that really means in the management and leader perspective. So let's go back to Ethan at WVU. Your second question kind of delves into this.
Absolutely. Well, during your years at Micrel, how did you effectively hold upper level management accountable when problems arose without completely eliminating that happiness factor? And vice versa, how did upper level management hold you accountable during times where you might not necessarily have performed at 100%?
So make sure that you're in the best mood. In other words, if you're in an upset or an angry mood when you're trying to hold somebody accountable, they're not going to be listening. They're going to be focusing on your mood. You know, how are you as a person, not what is the issue at hand. So if you're going to hold them accountable, make sure it's not that you've got the gallows up in the tree and you're ready to hang them, type mentality. You know, you say, how can I help you? You know, what can I do to help you be more successful as you approach a particular problem? So what could we have done more, as opposed to what could you have done more? What could we have done more? How could I have been more helpful to you in this particular area as you talk about their accountability? And what I always do is always focus on the things that they've done right. In other words, I start, okay, look at what, you know, boy, I'm sure appreciative of how well you handle this particular schedule. And so I compliment them before I start and saying, well, now in this other area, we seem to have some difficulties. And then we talk about that. And then I end with another positive. I say, again, thank you so much for working for the company. I appreciate your loyalty and so forth. So you start on a positive, talk about the negative, and then end on a positive. And then, of course, the way my board held me responsible, you know, depending upon the board member, some were good, some were not so good. Some were, they thought their job was there to bash on me and beat me up. And others were more kindly and understanding and looking at what was going right as opposed to what is going wrong. So it depends upon the approach that the board member took, you know, what their attitude was. Obviously some of the board members I wished would have left, you know, but you're kind of stuck with them because they're kind of hired by the shareholders. But hopefully that answers your question.
Well, certainly always some positive tension between the CEO and the board. And if everyone's working towards the same shared vision, then it tends to work out. More to brass tacks, we're going to go back to San Jose State University. And Sharik, he had a question concerning startups that are cash strapped, but have some considerable expenses during their formative stage. So Sharik?
So you touched on this earlier, but in a startup like mine, patents will cost like thousands of dollars, and music licensing can cost upwards of $1 million. For a cash-strapped startup like ours, how would you recommend that we secure the requisite funding?
Well, being cash-strapped is kind of normal. I mean, if you've got too much money, then you're just going to spend it. So I don't see anything wrong with being cash-strapped, because then you're more frugal. But you know, you need to find ways to to cut those expenses. Like, for example, legal, you might trade some stock or, you know, trade some equity to get that patent application done less expensively. And if it comes to, you know, getting a license for some music, again, you know, you negotiate it. You try to find out ways that you can capitalize on your relationship, and maybe they're willing to share some upside equity for giving you a better deal on the licensing. So there's always ways around the problem if you're practical. Oftentimes people raise too much money and then they spend it. And just because, you know, your company has a great value, like Uber has a high value, they don't make any money. And so to me, you know, if you don't make money, you're not a real company because you're not sustainable. So don't be a concern about being cash strapped. I think that's the way you want to be. You want to look at yourself as just, you know, having to always cut corners and find ways to run your company more cost effectively.
That's a great answer. There's always a wonderful tension in terms of making sure that you maintain rational frugality in an organization. Well, I want to thank all the Zen Starter students for being here and having just absolutely marvelous questions. This has been my favorite Tough Things First podcast to date. And that's saying a lot because I think we're approaching 150 episodes of this podcast so far. And so again, thank you to Ethan and Jonathan and Sharik and Glenn. And thank you, of course, Ray Zen, for your marvelous wisdom and passing it on to the next generation. And to our audience out there, if you have not yet read Tough Things First, then you need to get to it. Go to Amazon and order your copy today. It's becoming required reading at universities all around the country. And by all means, rate and review this podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and whatever resource you use to obtain your podcast, because that will let the rest of the world know that you have latched into one of the best minds with inside of business and technology. And tune in again next week for the next edition of the Tough Things First podcast.
You've been listening to Tough Things First, candid talk with Silicon Valley's longest serving CEO, Ray Zinn. Drop by the contact page at toughthingsfirst.com for more about the book, more podcasts, and links to Ray's Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn pages to keep up with Ray Zinn's wisdom daily.